Archibir. By the effulgence. Varmabhushanai. With ornaments and shields. Suradibi. Shining. Vishadai. Sharp and clean. Shastrai. With weapons. Sutarang. Excessively. Suyarashmibi. With the dazzling illumination of the sunshine. Devadanava Viranam. Of all the heroes of the parties of both the demons and the demigods. Dvajinyao. The two parties of soldiers, each one bearing his own flag. Pandunandana, O descendant of Maharaj Pandu. Vejatu, distinctly recognized. Viramalabi, with garlands used by heroes. Jadasam, of aquatics. Eva, just like. Sagaro, two oceans. Translation. O king, O descendant of Maharaj Pandu, the soldiers of both the demigods and demons were decorated by canopies, colorful flags, and umbrellas with handles made of valuable jewels and pearls. They were further decorated by fans made of peacock feathers and by other fans also. The soldiers, their upper and lower garments waving in the breeze, naturally looked very beautiful, and in the light of the glittering sunshine, their shields, ornaments, and sharp, clean weapons appeared dazzling. Thus, the ranks of soldiers seemed like two oceans with bands of aquatics. I'm just going to read the English because it's many, many verses. For the battle, the most celebrated commander-in-chief, Maharaj Bali, son of Arochana, was seated on a wonderful airplane named Vaihayasa. O king, this beautiful decorated airplane had been manufactured by the demon Maya and was equipped with weapons of all types of combat. If it was inconceivable and indescribable, indeed it was sometimes visible and sometimes not. Seated in this airplane under a beautiful protective umbrella and being fanned by the best of chamaras, Maharaj Bali, surrounded by his captains and commanders, appeared just like the moon rising in the evening, illuminating all directions. And the next one, which is text 19 to 24. Surrounding Maharaj Bali on all sides were the commanders and the captains of the demons, sitting on their respective chariots. Amongst them were the following demons: Vamuchi, Shambhara, Bana, Viprachiti, Ayomukha, Divmurdha, Kalanab, Praheti, Haiti, Ilva, Shakuni, Bhutasantapa, Vajradhangstra, Virochana, Hayagriva, Shankurshira, Kapila, Maghadundubi, Taraka, Chakradrik, Shumba, Vishumba, Jamba, Utkala, Arishta, Arishtanemi, Tripura Deep, Maya, the sons of Paloma, the Kaleyas, and the Nivatakavacha. All of these demons had been deprived of their share of the nectar and had shared merely in the labor of churning the ocean. Now they fought against the demigods, and to encourage their armies, they made a tumultuous sound like the roaring of lions and blew loudly on conch shells. Balabhit, Lord Indra, upon seeing the situation of his ferocious rivals, became extremely angry. In text 25, sitting on Airavata, an elephant who can go anywhere and who holds water and wine in reserve for showering, Lord Indra looked just like the sun rising from Udayagiri, where there are reservoirs of water. Purport. On the top of the mountain called Udayagiri are large lakes from which water continuously pours in waterfalls. Similarly, Indra's carrier, Airavata, holds water and wine in reserve and showers it in the direction of Lord Indra. Thus, Indra, king of heaven, sitting on the back of Airavata, appeared like the brilliant sun rising above Udayagiri. So just Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Tinamane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Prasthacha Jasitarane Mukam Karati Vachalam Pangam Langayate Girim Yat Kripa Tvamaham Vande Shri Guru Dinadharanam Vanshakalpaturubhyascha Kripasindhubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah. So this is a very interesting section of the Bhagavatam. Actually, this Leela goes on for many, many chapters in the eighth canto. About half of the canto is dedicated, and it goes on even after this chapter with the bewilderment of Lord Shiva, I believe, describing the battle, and then Mohini Murti's in interaction with Lord Shiva. So Krishna, by one stroke, he does many, many things. He teaches many, many things. I went through all these chapters, and I just, on the surface, I isolated about 15 to 20 different lessons that Krishna teaches in these in this Leela, as it's from the beginning where it starts, as Narayani Mataji described yesterday with the offense to Durvasa Muni, and then from there going on until it finally ends with Lord Shiva's experience with Mohini Murti. But right here, I was meditating on Lord Indra, trying to contemplate this very unique character, since the last verse and the two-line purport refers to Lord Indra's on Airavata. And we have so many interesting interactions with Lord Indra. I was actually thinking this morning that he's like the personification of Apichet Sudaracharya, because he's constantly, apparently, to our vision, he's making these very major offenses. It's not small offenses. He made a relatively small offense to Durvasa Muni and his carelessness by giving the garland casually to Airavata, who trampled it on the ground, and thus Durvasa Muni was offended. But at the same time, Indra has committed many blunders, not the least of which is caused the Govardhan Leela to take place, and trying to kill all the residents of Vrindavan. But on the other hand, if you look here and examine the progression of this pastime, you see that Indra really has remarkable qualities. Actually, all the demigods do. And that they're completely surrendered to the will of Lord Krishna, even though on one level they apparently have material desire. They're often attached to their kingdom. We see Indra affected by pride and arrogance and desire for his share of profit, adoration, and distinction. On the other hand, we see an extreme qualification in his willingness to first follow higher authority in the example of Lord Brahma, but also to accept Krishna as a supreme personality of Godhead, to be humbled almost immediately by Krishna's intervention in his life, and to when all things else fail, to go to Krishna for guidance and direction in his life. So we have this apparent dichotomy in his performance, that on one hand he has qualities which we don't particularly value, or we think are demoniac even at times. But on the other hand, they're greatly overshadowed, at least in the eyes of Krishna, they're greatly overshadowed by his desire to be a servant of Krishna and to do the right thing. And I was contemplating first with the beginning when, you know, the offense took place and the demigods lost everything. It was interesting. Indra committed the offense, but everybody suffered. All the demigods suffered because Indra is their king, their leader, on one level. And so they all were lost. They all lost their prestige. They all lost their wealth. It wasn't just Indra that suffered. It was all of them. So they all went to Lord Brahma, and Lord Brahma, of course, went to Chiradakshai Vishnu, and what to do? So that was the first thing. Okay, I'm confused about duty. What to do? So I go to my authority, and he goes to his authority, which is ultimately the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the word comes down in a very kind of strange way, right? Okay, here's what you should do. You should churn the ocean. And there's no question of what do you mean by churn the ocean, or how are we supposed to do that, or that seems like a crazy idea. And then on top of that, the instruction comes, there's going to be many things that come out of the ocean. Some of them are going to be inauspicious, like this halahala poison, which could destroy the whole world. But don't worry about it. It'll all get taken care of. And then there's going to be some valuable things that come out of the ocean. But don't covet them. Don't go after them. Just accept whatever happens, no matter how it may seem to be disturbing to you, no matter how much you may want one of these material things that pops out of the ocean. Don't go for it. And immediately, okay, as you like. And then even in process, because sometimes someone gives us an instruction and it's really easy when you're sitting in the room, you say, yeah, sure, okay, yeah, I'll do that. That's okay. Mm-hmm. I can handle that. But then when it comes to the process and you're actually in the heat of the moment, and the order was don't let your lower nature come forward, don't become greedy, don't become angry, don't become upset, then it's not so easy to carry out. When the object of your anger or the object of your greed or the object of your attachment is standing before you, it's not so easy to just say, okay, I'm not going to be disturbed by that. Yes, I can handle that. Very often we get really agitated and disturbed and we try to grab. But even as the churning of the ocean was going on, many, as Krishna or Vishnu predicted, many things happened. But the demigods, all of them, including Lord Indra, were able to kind of keep their cool. They didn't get disturbed. They didn't get agitated. They didn't pursue any of the material things. And they ultimately were completely controlled when Mohini Murti was on the scene. And the demigods didn't know exactly how that was going to work out. There was this nectar, this coveted somaras, and yet they were able to remain equipoised, and Mohini Murti managed to orchestrate it. The noticeable thing is that both times, even in the time after the churning of the ocean, the demigods, when they saw that the demons took the nectar, immediately again in their mind they were praying, we don't know how to, what should we do now? You told us not to get, you know, covetous about these things, not to pursue these things, but now the demons have stolen the nectar, and instead of following them, which they could have done, they prayed to Krishna. So then Mohini Murti took care of the problem, and the demigods got the nectar, but as could be predicted, the demons were not very happy. And even they, interesting enough, of course, Bali Maharaj has exceptional qualities, and ultimately we see that he isn't really a demon. He kind of showed his real nature when he came in contact with Vamanadeva. But anyway, the demons even were, they followed their promise. They said they wouldn't interfere with Mohini Murti, and the nectar was given to the demigods. And then after it was over, they said, okay, we're going to get that back, and then there was a war, a fight. But even in that fight, we hear now it's just about to begin, and it's almost like the Battle of Kurukshetra that's described in Bhagavad Gita and Mahabharata, when we see, you know, all the soldiers are lined up, and there's a vivid description given. You can almost see it as a Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer production before your senses, you know, the armor glittering and the sword shining and everybody looking so fantastically beautiful, and the camera focuses in on one and then the other, and we see them poised in a very princely, kingly manner, ready to fight this battle. And when the demons appear to be very qualified, we notice that Indra is not at all phased. He doesn't get angry. He doesn't get scared or frightened in any way. He gets instead fired up, more fired up to go into the battle. But after the battle is over, then Krishna, the demigods, they come and say, okay, now that's enough. The demons have been defeated. Now you should just stop. And immediately the war is over. It stops. So if we examine that, we can see that beneath the lower nature, there's a very powerful devotion, a very powerful faith in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in his guidance, that he could say, churn the ocean, and they said, sure, we'll churn the ocean. And don't be attached to anything, and sure, no problem, we won't be attached. Completely faithful that Krishna is orchestrating things for their ultimate benefit. So Krishna says that even if a devotee commits the most abominable action, still he's to be considered saintly because he's rightly situated. So we can see that here. At least when I was looking at this, this is what kind of jumped out at me, is that here is Indra, who we know is a devotee. I mean, it's not an ordinary thing to be able to have a direct conversation with Krishna. And Indra did that, right? After the Giridhari Leela, after the Govardhan Leela, Indra was able to discuss it with Krishna. He was able to stand there with Krishna, with Airavata, and apologize for his minor mistake of trying to kill all the residents of Vrindavan and all the cows. But he was able to talk to Krishna. He's taken up significant parts of the Bhagavatam. Here alone, many, many chapters of the Bhagavatam, and in so many other places also, we read about Indra and his pastimes, his activities. Many times, we read about him losing his temper or acting inappropriately. It becomes bewildering. But when we think about this promise of Krishna, this understanding of the devotee's relationship to Krishna, that when we have sincere devotion and willingness to surrender unto the will of the Supreme, then everything will work out okay. Even if occasionally, due to our material inclination, we act inappropriately. So this gives us some assurance that when all else fails, if we turn to Krishna, then Krishna will reciprocate with us if we maintain a devotional mentality. Mm. So in this section of the Bhagavatam, we see it very, very clearly that Indra is an exceptional person, and that Krishna has a plan. He has a strategic plan. It's not that these things are happening randomly. Krishna has figured it all out. He knows just what is happening. And each little part of it, from the churning of the ocean to the battle to the appearance of Mohini Murti more than once, Krishna is showing us in many, many, many different ways, ultimately moving us to the realization which will allow us to interact with him in intimacy in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So now we're getting closer and closer to the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And we know that the Bhagavatam progresses from the lotus feet of Krishna all the way up to this. We have to become qualified. We have to become qualified to read the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam and understand it. So here is one part of the puzzle where Krishna is teaching us again and again in so many different ways that ultimately Krishna is in control, that he has a plan, and everything he's doing is leading us ultimately to being able to surrender to him. And Indra, despite repeated difficulty, is confident of that plan. That's obvious. He's confident of that plan. He feels completely safe that whatever Krishna tells him, whatever Krishna organizes, that will take place. So sometimes we are tested. Do we have faith in that plan? Do we have the surrender, the mentality to be able to accept Krishna's plan unconditionally? Are we willing to just fall into Krishna's hands and accept that whatever he does will ultimately be for our benefit? It may be, it is going to be, according to Krishna's time, according to Krishna's place, according to Krishna's circumstance. He is going to craft this. And will we be able to accept it when it comes? Will we be able to accept the fact that it may not make sense to us? That we may look at it and it may not make sense to us. Just like we can imagine that, you know, the demigods heard, okay, churn the ocean. Did that make sense to them? Was that like something predictable that, okay, we're going to go and we have this problem, we've lost everything, what should we do? Well, churn the ocean. And with Mandara Mountain and Vasuki, and it's an interesting plan, an inconceivable plan. But the demigods were completely surrendered. Indra was completely surrendered. Queen Kunti, she was also completely surrendered to Krishna's plan. The Pandavas completely surrendered to Krishna's plan. Although Krishna's plan appeared to be incomprehensible on many, many occasions. Why is it that the demons appear to win? Why is it that they appear to get the wealth, the strength, the prestige? Why is it that Duryodhana is ruling in Hastinapur and the Pandavas are exiled to the forests? Why is it that they've lost everything and Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra have apparently conquered? They have everything. Why is it that there's so much suffering for the devotees very often, and they appear to lose all their wealth? Indra, he lost all his wealth. Why is it that way? But these great devotees, they're completely faithful to Krishna's plan, and so they don't, that question doesn't enter. Rather than praying for a change in material circumstances, they pray for understanding. They pray for the mercy to be able to see Krishna's hands in their lives, to be able to have a darshan with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to be able to surrender to him no matter what, even if you handle me roughly by your embrace, leave me brokenhearted by not appearing before me, please let me be, I accept you unconditionally as my Lord. Let me not be distracted by wealth or beauty or fame or anything, and let me just focus my mind at your lotus feet. Let me just surrender to the realization that everything is under your control. How difficult a realization. So when we compare, or at least when I compare, my own ability to see Krishna's hand in my life, when I contemplate even pain, even the slightest pain, having, you know, some owie, you know, a car accident, I'm fearful, extremely fearful. We're very afraid, or at least I'm very afraid, of the slightest suffering. No one, everybody wants to make every effort to avoid any kind of pain. But these great devotees accepted so much suffering and still didn't criticize or find Krishna to be acting wrongly or even become doubtful about Krishna's supremacy or Krishna's organizational abilities. They constantly redoubled their faith and determination to serve the Supreme Lord to the point where we know that prayer, Queen Kunti, where she prayed, let the calamities happen again and again. It doesn't matter. And I would rather be with you in trouble than not be with you and have everything fine. So this lesson that Lord Indra is teaching us is by his example, is a very potent lesson. And perhaps we don't see it sometimes. When we look at Indra, we often wonder, why, how does he do these things? And how does he become confused so often? And yet Krishna is constantly bailing him out. But Krishna is teaching us through the pages of the Bhagavatam that he will also bail us out if we have that complete faith and we have that complete conviction and we're willing to follow his order. Then he tells us that he'll preserve what we have and he'll provide what we lack. He'll carry us in moments of difficulty. And ultimately, everything that happens to us is in his will. We see that the demons, Prabhupada describes in the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that the demoniac have a mentality that by their own power, they will conquer. By their own power, they will have success. Whereas the devotees, the difference between those two classes of men is that the devotees, they don't depend on their own power. When the going gets rough, they pray. When there's difficulty in their lives, they take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the demons, when going gets rough, they sharpen their swords. They build up their muscles. They try to figure out new formulas, right? They invent new kinds of bombs, and they do research on better kinds of airplanes. They get better kinds of technology, and they think ultimately they'll conquer death if they get a new injection for that disease or a new kind of radiation treatment to solve the problem. But the devotee, he sees differently. He sees that it's by Krishna's mercy that things will change, because it's by Krishna's mercy that things are arranged. And there's a lesson to be learned. And if I can just still my restless mind and my uncontrolled senses, then I can receive that message. I can perceive that message. I can understand that message. The demigods went to hear from the Supreme Personality of Godhead and from their spiritual leader, Lord Brahma, because their minds were disturbed. They were suffering in the material sense. And so they went to hear, to take shelter, to understand, to move forward under the will of the Supreme Lord. And in that way, they were able to be successful. Another important lesson, and the last one that I'll speak of, even though there are many others, is that the demons, when they became successful by their own determination, they became greedy, and they became envious of each other. They started fighting with each other because they got the nectar. They weren't able to even divide it up amongst each other because they became so lusty and so greedy amongst each other that in their fighting, their mind became totally illusioned, and they became subjected to impotence. They became impotent. They had succeeded. They had churned the ocean. They had succeeded. They had gotten the nectar. But because of that tendency to feel superior, to be greedy, to have uncontrolled material desire, they spoiled everything. They fought with each other over what they had won, and they were unable to reap the benefit of their own effort. So in the same way, we as devotees have to be very careful. Lord Indra and the devotees, as soon as they become bewildered, they take shelter of Krishna. Rather than acting in that bewilderment and just making things worse, they take shelter of Krishna. Lord Arjuna, he prayed, "Now I'm confused about duty. I don't know what to do. I'm bewildered. My senses are out of control. Let me surrender." The demigods, they became poverty-stricken. They didn't know what to do. They became confused. They didn't fight amongst each other. They went and they said, "I'm confused. What should we do?" And Krishna arranged everything. So in the same way, we have to be careful that even in our successes, when we have some material strength or some spiritual success, we develop a nice community, we build a beautiful temple, we have nice deity worship, we have good association, we don't become bewildered and then fight amongst each other. Because very often that's what happens. We take these things for granted. And instead of being grateful for them, and instead of going to Krishna and thanking him and asking him, "Okay, how do we proceed now?" we tear them apart. We bring them down. And we destroy our own success. We destroy our own success. In traveling, very often I give classes outside the temple, in Namahata programs at people's homes. In many places in our movement, and even here, the vast majority of devotees are living outside. And very often the tendency is amongst those persons who have some degree of independence, some degree of apparent control over their own material lives. They have their own deities even, so they have their own little spiritual success in their living room. They tend to speak critically about the temple or about the organization of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness or the organization of devotees. And so I've started doing something when I speak to those devotees, that I start my program with one question. And the question is, would you be sad if the temple closed? And inevitably, there's dead silence after that question. And then everybody unanimously, after a few seconds, checks in with each other and shakes their head, yes. Are you willing to run it? Oh, no, I can't run it. I work, and I have a family, and I have my home, and I have my responsibilities. Okay, so then what is your responsibility for that? And what is your interaction with that? Is there any responsibility on your part? Do you just come and take? Is that how it works? That somebody manages to do this work, you criticize 90% of what goes on, and then you go home and you feel very proud of your independent spiritual prowess. But what would happen if it didn't exist? What would happen if the temple wasn't there for you to go to on Janmashtami, on so many other days, on to go to the Rath Yatra, to read the books that are printed by the BBC, so many different things. So we have to be grateful to that organization, to whatever faults it may have. Prabhupada said, ISKCON, with all your faults, I love you. So the organization of Srila Prabhupada's movement is our responsibility. And we have to appreciate it in our lives. Just like the demigods, they're very independent. They fought and they win and they get wealth and they have wives and they do all their thing. But when it comes down to it and things don't go their way, which it does do in life somehow, even though we think we have everything under control somehow, Krishna throws us a curveball and we see we're really not in control. It's an illusion of control, which is easily shattered. Then what do? Do we take shelter of Krishna, or do we try to adjust things by our own material prowess? And that's the difference between the divine and demoniac nature right there. That's the crux of it. When it comes down to that and we see how we behave, then we can judge. You know, it was stated in class the other day that in the age of Kali, the divine and the demoniac, they exist within one individual. Sometimes we have that visual of the devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other, you know, and should I or shouldn't I? And the guys are going, no, come on over here. No, do this. So, but the question is, who's going to win? when the countdown comes, you know, you get that count for the final knockout, who's going to be the one standing? And when the going gets rough, who we take shelter of will determine who is the victor. So I'll stop there. And if there's any questions, I'll try to answer. Hare Krishna, Keshav.
Thank you so much for that clarity. I am sometimes confused about the verse, Apichet Sudaracharu, because it says if one is properly situated, and even if he makes a fall down, you know, he should be considered a sadhu.
Even if he does an abominable action.
Abominable action, just see.
That's a heavy word.
So so what does it mean? Like those who are coming to Mangal Arati, I mean those who follow the different processes, if they have a fall down, are they properly situated? Or is it like those who are not coming to the temple, you don't see them much, we don't know what they're doing? You know, they don't have any contact with the devotees. Once in a while, you see them at Rath Yatra. How is it? Or I don't know if it's even necessary to understand that. In my mind, I'm just thinking, how can I really clarify that?
Well, I think you'll be hard-pressed to find an injunction in Shastra that says you're offering too much respect to somebody. So if you have to err, I would suggest erring on the side of offering as much respect as possible. Now, it's described in the Nectar of Instruction that there are different ways to respect different levels of devotees, and we, from our Kanishta, or at best Madhyama position, we sometimes have a hard time with our naked eyes ascertaining who is, like you said, we see them here, and we see them here, and we see them do this. Krishna isn't limited by our vision. He's in the heart. So he sees everything from the inside out. And therefore, he makes the decisions, ultimately, who this Apichet Sudaracharo verse depends on. I mean, who gets the benefit of that doubt. So that's Krishna's department. It's not really our department. However, occasionally we may be in a position where we have to decide. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says we should take association of like-minded Vaishnavas. So those standards that we value, we associate with people that inspire us to value them. But we don't have to judge others. That's not essential. Although we may choose to offer them respect from a distance, or we may choose to offer respect by falling down in obeisance and then not take their association. But still, if you have to make a choice, it's better to consider them saintly. Why should you? What would be the benefit of considering them not saintly? As long as you are protected, if necessary, from following bad instruction or disobeying the order of your spiritual master. So as long as you're able to carry out your process and your understanding of your relationship with your spiritual master and the instructions that are very clearly given to us by Srila Prabhupada, then offering respect to somebody isn't going to cost you anything. And not offering respect to somebody could cost you really a lot. So, you know, and we see, like with Dhruva Maharaj, you know, Suniti thought, or Suruchi thought, he's just a kid, what does he know? You know, he's not qualified to sit on his father's lap. He has to take birth in my womb. She made a big mistake. She didn't recognize Dhruva Maharaj's greatness. Dhruva was only 5 years old. So better to err on the side of respect and consider people saintly. You don't have to follow their direction. Considering them saintly doesn't mean that they become necessarily your mentor. But certainly we should offer respect. And then ultimately Krishna makes the decisions. In terms of the ultimate decision as to whether somebody is saintly or not. Because he's seated within the heart, he doesn't have a problem with it. Now, I don't know if that's helpful, because we want to know. I mean, that's our nature. We want to know. It would be really nice if everybody walked around with a sign that said, Kanishta level 3, Majjam level 1, Uttama beginning. But it doesn't work that way somehow. And so therefore, we're not able necessarily to know. But we have to be humble enough that when we do see a sign, we accept it right away. We have the example of Jagadananda, right? When he came to see Pundarik Vidyanidhi, right? He was confused. He thought, wait, who is this guy? You know, he's all dressed up and he's smoking a hookah. And I mean, if we walked into a devotee's house and they were doing the same thing, we would no doubt not classify them amongst the saintly. But Mukunda, understanding Jagadananda's confusion, began to chant some verse from the Bhagavatam. Huh? Excuse me? Oh, Gadadhar, sorry. Gadadhar. So Mukunda started to chant some verse from the Bhagavatam about Putana, Krishna's relationship to Putana, and immediately Gadadhar was able to see, oh my gosh, I blew it. And he only committed a mental offense. I mean, it wasn't like he said anything. He just thought in his mind, I don't get it. Look at this guy. His hair is all oiled up, and he's all dressed up. So we have to be prepared that our mind may make a mistake. That does happen occasionally. That our mind may make a misjudgment, and therefore we have to be prepared to be humble enough to accept that misjudgment. Another thing is that we do tend to rely on what we see. But spiritual progress is not necessarily always accurately portrayed by what you see. And so you have to be very careful about that too. And it's difficult for us because we are not trikalagya, we're not really tuned in to other people's spiritual energy, to use a New Age term, but to other person's spiritual advancement. So it's difficult for us to ascertain besides what they see, what we see. So therefore we have to act on what we see, but we have to act cautiously. We have to act cautiously with humility and I think maybe even more important with the intention of getting to the real truth. In the tenth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes himself as one of his opulences is that he's the Vata truth, the Vada truth. That he, and if you examine that, what that means is because in logic, in an argument, there's different ways of going about it. You can go about it to win. You know, that I'm going to prove myself right, and if I prove myself right, then I win. But the truth that Krishna says he is the desire to get to the core of the matter, to find out the real truth. And the real truth may not be so easy to ascertain sometimes. But if our intention is that we really want to do the right thing by everybody, we want to really see what the best thing is, then we'll act according to the need of the situation. But ultimately, we want to get to the right truth, then Krishna will reveal it to us. Just like with Gadadhar, he was able to see the right truth, even though he had made a mistake, but then he was able, and he rectified it, right? He rectified it. He felt, oh my gosh, I committed an offense. The only way this is going to become rectified is if I take initiation from Pundarik. And that was a good solution. So we need to, excuse, just 1 minute, we need to be willing. I'm going to have to end because I have to go teach another class. Okay, I'm sorry.
There was a lot of big Brahmins. I'm sorry. A lot of big Brahmins. I can't help it. You know, just a lot of big Brahmins were there, and all his disciples were there too. And Srila Prabhupada gave, in MP3, you can hear this lecture, whoever is interested. Prabhupada says, these boys and girls, they have one thing you all don't have. I was very attentive on that when Prabhupada was talking. I was hearing this 10 times. He said, they have Ananyabhav, the same verse. Apicheto suduracharo bhajate mam Ananyabhav. Ananyabhav means one-pointed. And Prabhupada explains this, what it is, in that lecture on his appearance day. He says, these boys and girls, they are not interested of worshipping like you all worship, this demigod, that demigod. They are completely surrendered under Guru to worship and please Krishna. Very nice. Mm-hmm. This is the qualification Prabhupada gave.
Thank you very much. So I have to end because I have to go teach another class. But thank you very much. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.